Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Welcome, everybody, to Histories of the Unexpected, the show in which we explain how everything has a history, even the most unexpected of subjects, like pretzels, pianos, and leering.
Oh, I don't like the sound of doing a history of leering, Sam. However, we will be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, who knew, and this is a very Christmas-themed one here, that the history of toys is in fact all about hidden Viking children, or that the history of tattoos is all about imperial domination and ownership in the Roman Empire.
The man not sitting opposite me because we're self-isolating, but he will nevertheless help pilot us through these micro-histories. He's one of the country's leading professors of histories. It's Professor Extraordinaire James Daybell. Hello, James.
Hello, Sam. And the man not sitting opposite me, but ably helping me co-pilot these episodes during lockdown, is the famous historical adventurer, Dr. Sam Willis.
This is the sixth, James, we're on six already, of
goodness
our
me.
Special Christmas-themed micro-histories in which we embrace the task of demonstrating how an unexpected subject not only has a history, but is massively important and interesting in just 15 minutes. And we do it without just talking faster. We start with a shared example, then have just 5 minutes each to make a case for an interesting history on that very unexpected subject. Contributions are rigorously timed.
And you, our dear listeners, you will get to vote on social media on what you think was the most interesting fact that you heard in the episode.
Today's topic, inspired by Christmas, believe it or not, is the wonderful history of rioting. James, where are we going to begin?
Well, nothing says Christmas quite like a riot. And we're going to go back to the 17th century here, because Christmas has often been about violence and rioting, as much as it is about caring and sharing. It's well known, for example, that Oliver Cromwell and the Puritans sought to abolish Christmas. They viewed it as a popish superstition. And one ordinance was passed by Parliament. In other words, a law was passed by Parliament in June 1647, which threatened with punishment anyone who celebrated the festival of Christmas. Now, as you can imagine, this ban did not go down very well in all quarters. And in December 1647, many of the citizens of the city of Canterbury defied it, taking to the streets to riot. And there was a pamphlet printed at the time, a pamphlet entitled Canterbury's Christmas, or a True Relation of the Insurrection in Canterbury on Christmas Last, which describes how shops that stayed open on this holy day were ransacked, the mayor, aldermen and constables attacked, the sheriff himself knocked down, and, I quote, his head fearfully broke. It was God's mercy his brains were not beat out.
Whoa, I've never had my head broke. I don't like the sound
no,
of that.
No, nor have I.
Does it mean literally cracked open?
Yeah, vinegar and brown paper is like split open. I know.
Anyway, in another example, this one is from America in 1776. It's the start of the American Revolutionary War. There's a rebel militia guarding the maritime route to Canada from America at Fort Ticonderoga. And it's a sort of a crazy simmering pot of class and cultural rivalry in this very isolated outpost. And it's exacerbated by cold and boredom. And they all get smashed on Christmas Day. And it turns into, an unbelievable riot of extreme violence. And the soldiers turn on each other like hungry dogs. A recently discovered personal account noted how Pennsylvania soldiers, armed with guns, bayonets and swords, by force entered the tents and huts of Massachusetts officers and soldiers, dragging many out of doors naked and wounding them, robbing and plundering. So there you go, rioting in the wilderness in the American Revolution. That particular episode didn't end very well at all. If you want to find out more about this remote part of the Hudson Highlands and how it's instrumental to the outcome of the American Revolution, you need to read my book, The Struggle for Sea Power. Anyway, enough of that plug there, James. Where do we go from here? We've done a bit of history of rioting there at Christmas, but what about other types of riots?
Aha! Well, this takes us to the 1990s.
Right, stop. And... I'm going to begin you now.
Okay,
you
okay,
have,
yes.
You have, James. You have got 5 minutes. Beginning in 3, 2, 1, go.
Well, as I said, this takes us to the very early 1990s and the poll tax riots relating to Mrs. Thatcher. Mrs. Thatcher, who was there, also known as Milk Snatcher. The poll tax riots were... These were a series of riots in British towns and cities during this period. And what they were revolting against was something called the community charge, which was known colloquially as the poll tax. This was brought in by Mrs. Thatcher and her Conservative government of the period. And what it did was it actually transformed the way in which local taxes were levied. And it replaced a rate system. Now, a rate system had been a fairly equitable system of taxation, which was based on property ownership. So effectively, each household paid on the basis of the size of the house that they had, which is very similar to the sort of council tax that we have nowadays, that sort of system. Whereas the poll tax was levelled on the individual to pay. Now, this is a very sort of regressive tax system. Effectively, what that means is it's something that penalises the poor and subsidises the rich. While registered unemployed and students only paid 20%, some large families living in a council house, for example, had to pay for every single member of the house. So if you were a mother and father with five kids, seven of you would be paying that rather than one lump sum. And of course, this was extremely unpopular.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
We see setting up a whole series of organisations against it. So in November 1989, the All Britain Anti-Poll Tax Federation was set up. We've got groups such as 3D, Don't Register, Don't Pay, Don't Collect. And there are a series of marches to demonstrate against this. And one of the most famous was one on the 31st of March 1990, in London, which met in Kennington Park, and then pours out around London. There are estimated between 180,000 and 250,000 people, a huge crowd. It starts at about 1:30 in the afternoon. By 2:30, they've got into Trafalgar Square. By 3 p.m., the march stops in Whitehall. And the police around Downing Street get really concerned. And there's very heavy-handed sort of police presence here. The whole thing overspills. And by 4 p.m., when the rally is almost over, the crowd sort of gets out of control. And by 4:30, the police have closed down the train stations in the sort of surrounding area around Trafalgar Square. And from about 5 p.m. onwards, we see rioting beginning. And what happens is then people get funneled out of Trafalgar Square. They get funneled down Northumberland Avenue. They get funneled into the sort of wealthy parts of London around the West End and those shopping streets. And there are reports of people just going wild and overturning cars and looting goods and breaking shop windows across Oxford Street, Regent Street, into Covent Garden. And the whole thing is to basically protest against, it's to riot against the poll tax. And about 113 people were injured. And about 339 people were arrested. And it continued on into the early hours of the night until about 3 a.m. And it shows, really, the real sort of distrust with the Conservative government of Mrs. Thatcher, the real concern that people have with the inequitability of the poll tax. And in fact, when John Major came into power, one of the first things that he did was to actually axe the poll tax and introduce the council tax, which came into effect in 1992. And an opinion poll that was conducted in 1990 suggested that about 78% of the population opposed the tax.
That, James, believe it or not,
what's that?
That your alarm was the poll tax riot of 1990.
Excellent. I love that, Sam.
Yeah, it's shockingly violent what's actually going on there. Everyone go onto YouTube and have a look at the riots of the poll tax, because that brings to home just how fearful these things can be. You can finish your sentence and then conclude, James Daybell.
So I had finished my sentence, but there you go, Sam. Rioting is all about Britain in the 1990s, Mrs. Thatcher and the poll tax riots. And I must admit, I find contemporary history like that immensely challenging. And hats off to those historians who are able to perform the Herculean task of historical objectivity on a topic like that. I found it very difficult to stay dispassionate. Okay, over to you, Sam. Right. What are you going to talk to us about?
I'm going to talk to you about India. Give me my 5 minutes. Go.
Okay, you have a very strict 5 minutes. On your marks, get set, go now.
I am going to be talking about India, the British Empire in India, more specifically, and the pattern of growing violence there, which led to the Indian Mutiny of 1857. It really is a fascinating piece of history, not only because of the violence that you can see, and you can really plot these episodes of extreme violence and rioting and fighting throughout the British presence in India, but there's a balance to it. And when there is some wonderful examples of peaceful protest as well, I think I'll keep the descriptions of the peaceful protests until we should do an episode on peace, James, I think. But we're going to do something on rioting now. Here's a bit of background, some dates for you. 1756, the Black Hole of Calcutta. Bet many of you have heard of that. That is when the Nawab of Bengal attacks a British settlement in Calcutta and imprisons 146 colonists. He puts them in a space measuring just 6 metres by 8 metres, causing 123 of them to die. So some extreme violence there. 1757, there's a big battle. Robert Clive leads troops to victory against the Nawab of Bengal. Now, I'm going to fast forward you to 1857. So this is a century and 1 year after that Black Hole of Calcutta event. And we have the Indian Mutiny. It's a violent rebellion against British involvement in India. As part of the rebellion, there's a great deal of massacres. Families of British troops are massacred. 200 women and children are killed. And what I wanted to do was read you a bit of the description, of the mutiny. This is from Elisa Greathead, a British woman living in Meerut with her husband at the time of the incident. And she writes down her experiences on the 10th of May, 1857. That's the day that the rebellion really begins in earnest. After hearing a commotion in the distance and being warned of the danger, there's a sense of pressure building up over time. She and her husband take shelter on the rooftop of their house. The increasing tumult, thickening smoke and fires all around convinced us of the necessity of making our position as safe as we could. Our guard were drawn up below. After dark, a party of insurgents rushed into the grounds, drove off the guard and broke into the house and set it on fire. On all sides, we could hear them smashing and plundering and calling loudly for us. It seemed once or twice as though footsteps were on the staircase, but no one came up. We owed much to the fidelity of our servants. Had but one proved treacherous, our lives must have been sacrificed. After some time, the flames got the ascendant and the smoke became intolerable. Just as the fire threatened our destruction, we heard the voice of one of our servants calling to us to come down. At all risks, we descended. Our faithful servant, Golab Khan, seeing our perilous situation amidst the increasing flames, and that every moment was precious, with his characteristic presence of mind and quickness, had suddenly thought of a plan by which to draw away the mob, who, after having satisfied themselves with all the plunder they could get, were every moment becoming more eager in their search for us. He boldly went up to them, won their confidence by declaring himself of their faith and willing to give us up to their hands. He assured them it was useless to continue their search in the house, but if they would all follow him, he would lead them to a haystack where we had been concealed. The plan succeeded, and so convinced were they that what he had told them was the truth, that not a man remained behind. In this interval we got safely down. Not a human being was to be seen near the house, but we had only just time to escape into the garden when the mutinous crowd returned, madder than ever at the deception that had been practised on them. Never was dawn more welcome to us than on the 11th of May. The daylight showed how complete the work of destruction had been. All was turned into ruin and desolation, and our once bright, happy home was now a blackened pile. Sad was the scene, but thankfulness for life left no place for other regrets. With the morning light, the mob had all dispersed, and we had no difficulty in making our way to the Dragoon lines, where we were the most cordially welcomed by our friends Captain and Mrs. Cookson. They had felt the greatest apprehension as to our fate, knowing that as we were out of cantonments, no help could have been given to us. We had been utterly cut off from all communication through the night, and sad was the tale of murder and bloodshed we now heard. So it's a fascinating description there of the riotings that that happened at the beginning of the Indian Mutiny and turned into full-scale fighting. And all the more significant when you consider the subsequent peaceful demonstrations against British rule, summed up by Mohandas Gandhi, and the Salt March in 1930, which is a wonderful example. What have I got there, James?
Well, I didn't want to do... I wanted to be subversive. I wanted to riot against this and do something a little more topical.
Oh, wow!
I thought that was more riotous than a riot. Plus, I got the LA 1992 riots up, and my YouTube didn't work. So I thought I'd do a sound effects bar instead.
Very good, very good. Anyway, I can finish now. You can see how rioting in this instance is actually all about British rule in India. Resentment, methods of protest and resistance, loyalty and servitude. Absolutely fascinating. I hope you've enjoyed that little micro-history on the history of rioting and its links with Christmas. Do please follow me on social media. I'm at Dr. Sam Willis.
And I am at James Daybell. And the podcast is at Unexpected Pod. We're also on Facebook and Instagram. And we have a website, historiesoftheunexpected.com, where you can find out all about our back catalogue and everything that we have been up to over the last million years.
Well, it feels like it sometimes, doesn't it? Thanks all for listening, guys. We'll be back with some more Christmas micro-history soon. Cheerio.
And happy Christmas, everyone.